In the 10th chapter of Daniel, we are told that Daniel had a vision in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. According to Expositor's Bible Commentary, the third year of Cyrus was about 535 to around 534 B.C., in all probability just a few years before Daniel's death. The angel Gabriel explained that he had been sent to give Daniel the understanding of the vision he had seen, which dealt with the fate of the Jews in the latter days, and that's in Daniel 10:14. His explanation of the prophecy actually begins in the 11th chapter of Daniel, where we find the longest continuous prophecy in the Bible. It details events affecting the Jews from the 5th to the 1st centuries BCE. According to eternal dating of Daniel, it was compiled during the mid-6th century BC. Daniel 11 alone contains over 100 specific prophecies of historical events that literally came true. This chapter is amazing proof of the divine inspiration of Scripture. Brethren, today we are going to take a look at Daniel 11, at the prophecies that came true, and answer the question, were these truly inspired by God and given to Daniel to write down, or are they fabrications written many centuries after Daniel lived? Let's answer the first question first, and then we'll examine Daniel 11. The prophecies of Daniel provide proof of the accuracy of the Bible. Many of his prophecies are so detailed, so specific, that they have long confounded Bible critics. They do not want you to believe that God gave Daniel these prophecies. Some skeptics have not really challenged the content of Daniel's prophecies accuracy. They do not want to admit that his words are indeed inspired. So instead, they have simply labeled his book as a fraud. The whole book of Daniel as a fraud. Think about that. They claim it was not written by Daniel in the 6th century BC when Daniel lived, but it was penned by an unknown author in the 160s BC or BCE, long after many of the events prophesied in the book came to pass. This, the critics allege, is the real reason for the book's startling prophetic accuracy. Now, this information I'm about to read here, this is from the United Church of God's Bible Commentary from research that was done by Tom Robinson. Daniel's testimony challenges the critics, but let's first consider the nature of the critics' approach. They dispute Daniel's authorship because he refers to himself in the earlier chapters in the third person as if writing about someone else. However, as the Expositor's Bible Commentary points out, this was the custom among ancient authors of historic memoirs. In relating some of his experiences, Daniel did write in the first person. Daniel 7:15, Daniel 8:15, Daniel 9:2, Daniel 10:2. A couple examples there. The identity of Daniel's critics was also significant as well. The first person to question the authenticity of Daniel's authorship was the Greek scholar and historian Porphyry. Got a weird, interesting name here. He actually lived in about 233 to 304 AD. He is labeled by historians as a Neoplatonist, which means he subscribed to the doctrines of the Greek philosopher Plato rather than the Bible. Porphyry is also known as a violent opponent of Christianity and a defender of paganism. That's according to the Encyclopedia Britannica. Since Porphyry was an enemy of Christianity, his objectivity is open to question. He had no factual basis for his opinion, and his view contradicted the testimony of Jesus Christ, who referred to Daniel as the author of the book in Matthew 24, verse 15. The biblical scholar Jerome, who lived during in A.D. 340 to 420, refuted Porphyry's contention. Thereafter, no one took Porphyry's remarks seriously again until many centuries later. Expositor says that he was more or less dismissed by the Christian scholarship as a mere pagan detractor who had allowed a naturalistic bias to warp his judgment. But during the time of the Enlightenment, in the 18th century, all supernatural elements of the scripture came under suspicion. Some of today's scholars with liberal leanings have recycled these century-old arguments. Old Testament historian Eugene Morrell says their beliefs are built on feeble evidence. Daniel's rhetoric and language are the enmity at home in the 6th century B.C., meaning that the language he was used was actually used during that time frame. It is only on a more subjective and circular lines of evidence that the man and his writing have been denied historically. The prophecies found in Daniel, especially in chapter 11, have caused some liberal Bible scholars to assign a much later date to the book of Daniel. As this quote from the Oxford Companion to the Bible plainly demonstrates, the book of Daniel is one of the few books of the Bible that can be dated with precision. That dating makes it the latest of all the books of the Hebrew Bible, and yet it is still early enough to have been known by the sectarian community at Qumran, which flourished between the 2nd century BCE and 68 CE or AD. What sectarian community are they speaking of, and how is this relevant? This sectarian group were known as the Essenes. Like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they were another division of the Jewish religion. Some believe they were actually a small branch which sprung out from the Pharisees, since they believed much of the same. However, they were a little bit more rigid, and to avoid the rituals that were going on at the temple, they went into seclusion around Qumran near the Dead Sea. They were kind of like monks living off the land and devoted to the Jewish religion pretty strictly, conforming to all the Ten Commandments, and keeping the Sabbath very strictly as well. What they are mostly noted for is they kept copies of the biblical manuscripts and are believed to be responsible for preserving these manuscripts from the Roman invasion by hiding them in caves, the Dead Sea Scrolls. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947 is widely considered the greatest archaeological event of the 20th century. Bedouin treasure hunters and archaeologists ultimately found the remains of hundreds of ancient scrolls. They haven't even sorted through all of them yet. These fragile pieces of parchment and papyrus, including the oldest existing copies of the Hebrew Bible, were preserved for 2,000 years by the hot, dry desert climate in the darkness of the caves where they were placed. The scrolls provide an unprecedented picture of the diverse religious beliefs of ancient Judaism and the daily life during the turbulent Second Temple period when Jesus lived and preached. Fragments of every book of the Hebrew Bible, except the book of Esther, were found in the Qumran caves, the most famous of the Dead Sea Scroll sites. Remarkably, some of these ancient copies are identical to the traditional texts of the Hebrew Bible that is used today. There was no deviation. The Essenes kept these manuscripts and believed them to be inspired by God and part of the Testament of God. Of course, at that time, there was only one Testament. We call it the Old Testament. There is a total of 8 known manuscript fragments from Daniel, so far from the Dead Sea Scrolls. From this information, we can say that the book of Daniel was most definitely accepted as inspired and canonical by at least 150 BCE or so, making this claim that it was written by some fake Daniel around 160 BCE seeming impossible. You know, and it's the likelihood that a Daniel autobiography by a fake author would have been circulated and accepted by the Jews as scripture within 10 or so years is essentially zero. Because it wouldn't have had much time. When you think about it. While we're on this date, they actually try to say that this date when Daniel was written was 164 or 65 BCE. Which some critics say Daniel was written, and to make another point though here, according to the current historical critical option or opinion, the book of Daniel originated in its present form in the Antiochus Epiphanes crisis, that is between 168, 167 to 164, 165 BC. So it seems very difficult to perceive that one single desert community is as strict as the Essenes were with scripture should have preserved such a significant number of Daniel manuscripts if this book had been produced at such a large or late date. See, what we're getting at here is part of the prophecy, which we're going to see. It's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. They're actually saying it was written about the same time that he was existing. Therefore, it ain't prophecy. And there's no way that somebody could have written it that quickly and then all of these people accept it and have that many of these manuscripts there. There was a large number of these manuscripts that was in this community. So there's no way that you can say that it was somewhere around the Maccabean time frame that this book of Daniel was written. It had to have been way before that period of time. Most likely when Daniel was living and Daniel actually wrote it. There's a lot of proofs out there to dismiss this whole thing. Again, they don't want you to believe that Daniel was so specific in these prophecies, because this is proof that the Bible is true and the Word is true. If they can dismiss this and say it was written by somebody that was fake. Other proofs. Regardless of how the liberal scholars and doubting theologians now view Daniel, as I stated before, Jesus proclaimed him to be a prophet. Look at Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. Matthew chapter 24, verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, and I don't need to read the rest of it, but here's the thing, spoken by Daniel the prophet. Here, Jesus Christ's own word declares that Daniel was a prophet. And the book of Daniel was out there, he would not have said that, oh, that fake guy that said he was Daniel, it doesn't make sense. It's also in Mark chapter 13 and verse 14. It says the exact same thing, where Jesus Christ declares that Daniel was a prophet. And right there, I take that. That's enough proof to me that he was the author of the book. Jesus Christ spoke it. Therefore, we can trust all the prophecies given to Daniel. And we're just talking about chapter 11 right now. Think of all the other things that was mentioned. Also, you want to turn to Isaiah chapter 46. Isaiah chapter 46. See, foretelling the future is not a difficult thing for God at all. In Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 and 10, as God states right here, "For I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, things that are not yet done." Right there, God is saying that he can predict the future. He can tell you what the future holds. The accuracy of Daniel's prophecies of remotely distant events is spectacular. For example, in the 70 weeks prophecy recorded in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27, Daniel predicts the precise year of Christ's appearance in the beginning of his ministry in AD 27. So think about that. If he wrote it in 165 BCE, that was still a few hundred years before Christ appeared on the scene. But no, he wrote it back when he wrote it. And there are many other amazing prophecies that are recorded by Daniel, like his interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. I want to read one more thing. I got this from the Good News, an article from the one of the past Good News magazines. Basically, it's a story from Josephus writing that confirms that Daniel's prophecies were received centuries before Alexander the Great conquered the world. Although Alexander the Great conquered Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and the surrounding countries, modern historians have little to say about him visiting the Holy Land. Yet ancient history says that he had a most remarkable encounter there, not only visiting the temple in Jerusalem, but also making a sacrifice to the God of Israel. Most modern historians dismiss the story, but one wonders why they do. Why do they? Could it be that they would have to admit there's a God of history who controls the course of nations? The noted first century Jewish historian Josephus records the king's visit to Jerusalem in a meeting between Alexander and the high priest Jaddua. I hope I'm saying his name right. In 332 BC, Alexander besieged and defeated the coastal cities of Tyre and Gaza in his march towards Egypt. During this campaign, he turned toward Jerusalem. Alexander had already demanded men and supplies from the Jews, who were still under the rule of Alexander's mortal enemy, the Persian king Darius. The high priest hesitated, saying that while Darius lived, they would honor their pledge. Alexander was angry and began to move on the city. Well aware of the danger, Jaddua asked the people to pray to God for his mercy and protection. Then, says Josephus, that Jaddua had a dream as to how to entreat the Macedonian king. He and the other priests, dressed in their priestly robes and accompanied by others dressed in white garments, formed a procession that went out of the city to a carefully chosen place to meet the king as he was approaching. Alexander then did the unexpected. When he saw them, he alone approached the high priest and the members of the procession to greet them. He did a remarkable thing there. I looked at some other things where what Josephus was saying is he actually, you know, bowed down towards the high priest. Well, one of his generals saw that how he welcomed that group, and he was kind of questioning why Alexander bowed down. Alexander replied, "I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with his high priesthood." So he's honoring God, the God of the Jews. "For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit or garment, when I was in Dios in Macedonia, who when I was considering with myself how to obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither, that he would conduct my army and would give me dominion over the Persians. Hence it is that having seen no other in that habit and now seeing this person in it and remembering that vision in the exhortation that I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, and all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind." This is stated in Josephus' writings. Josephus records that Alexander then accompanied the priest into Jerusalem and to the temple, where he offered a sacrifice to God, according to the high priest's direction. Now, here's an interesting thing that happened there. It was capped off by a briefing from a book. This is 332 BC, when Alexander was in Jerusalem at the temple. The book was the book of Daniel. You can see why nobody wants anybody to know about this and why they discredit Josephus, who's a really good historian for the Jews, up there with Tacitus and some of the others that were historians. Basically, what happened here is the high priest showed Alexander where he was mentioned in the book of Daniel as this great Greek king that's going to come and overthrow and take over Persia. And that's exactly what happened. I can read more on this, but I'll just skip through that. I hope you get the point. Bottom line, Alexander was shown the book of Daniel. So the book of Daniel existed back then. And again, that's why they don't want you to know. Now, I've said a lot about Daniel. So now let's open our Bibles to Daniel 11. This begins the king of the north and the king of the south. In verse number 5, also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall not be, or shall be a great dominion. 20 years later, from this division that they had when they split up the kingdom in 281 BCE, Seleucus, he killed Lysimachus in battle. So basically, there was only two dynasties that remained of Alexander's old empire. The Seleucid kings of the north and the Ptolemaic kings of the south. So here we go into the kings of the north and the kings of the south. In verse number 6, at the end of some of these years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But when she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. So in 249 BCE, the king of the south, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, sent his daughter Berenice to the king of the north, Antiochus II Theos. His plan was to stop a war that was raging. It was the second, it was known as the Second Syrian War, and to unite the two kingdoms through this marriage. Unfortunately, his plan had a little bit of a flaw. Antiochus was already married. However, because he knew this marriage to Ptolemy's II's daughter would ensure peace and allow him to regain most of the Syrian possessions that his father had lost to the king of the south, Antiochus II put away his wife, Laodicea, and married Berenice. She persuaded him to reject Laodicea's children and set up her own to succeed him on the throne. Laodicea, they actually made a town named after her, Laodicea. The Laodicean church, Laodicea, this is where that name actually came from, is this wife. However, there was a problem now, which continues to fulfill this prophecy by Daniel. After Ptolemy II died, in 246 BCE, Antiochus repudiated his marriage to Berenice and left her and her infant son to return to Laodice. Doubting his faithfulness, Laodice quickly murdered Antiochus II with poison. She then convinced her son, Seleucus II, Kalinicus, a lot of interesting names here, to kill both Berenice and her son. So just as the prophecy said would happen, Ptolemy II, king of the south, his daughter Berenice, and Antiochus, the king of the north, all lost in their struggle for power. Which brings us to verse number 7. I know this is a little bit tedious, but I'm trying to give you some of the history, and what I really want to show here is these things absolutely happened in history and was fulfilled and fulfilled these prophecies. Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army into the fortress of the king of the north and deal with them and prevail. Now Ptolemy the third, Ergetes, the eldest son of Ptolemy the second and brother of Berenice, was not happy at all about the murder of his sister. He immediately invaded the Seleucid Empire. His armies defeated the forces of the new king of the north, Seleucus II, who was the son of Antiochus I and Laodicea. His campaign was successful, and his armies achieved victory from the Tigris River to the coast of Asia Minor. Ptolemy III captured and put to death Laodicea. He even was able to enter the Seleucian and in the port on the Tigris River in the capital of Antioch and leave a garrison there. This was also kind of considered part of the Laodicean War that was going on as well. But if you notice the Antiochus, they named the capital there in Syria Antioch, after Antiochus. It was believed that it was probably one of the fathers or the son that the name was given to. And it wasn't the only place, because there was the one right there in Syria, but there was also another Antioch up in Asia Minor. In fact, there was several cities that they named Antioch. So there's another familiar name, and to kind of show where the history and the background of that name came from, as well as Laodicea. And of course, Antioch is the place where Jesus' followers were first called Christians. Verse 8. And he shall carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and the precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So during the Third Syrian War, the king of the south, Ptolemy III, is credited with recovering many of the sacred statues that the Persian forces of, Cambyses had carried off during their conquest of Egypt some 300 years earlier. Because of this, he was known as Ergetes, which means benefactor. Ptolemy III acquired much gold and silver during his victorious campaign. In fact, from Seleucia alone, he received 1,500 talents of silver annually as tribute. It's about 10% of his annual income was coming from there. He outlived Seleucus II, who died after falling from his horse by 4 or 5 years in 222 BCE. Verse 9, also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but he shall return to his own land. So in 240 BC, the king of the north, Seleucus II, attempted to invade Egypt in response to humiliation that he suffered at the hands of Ptolemy III. However, he had to return in defeat after his fleet perished in a storm. Verse 10, however, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overthrow or overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. So the sons of Seleucus II were Seleucus III, Seronuus, which means thunder, and Antiochus III, which was also known as Antiochus the Great. Seleucus III, the eldest son of Seleucus II, began a war against the Egyptian province in Asia Minor. However, he was unsuccessful and was assassinated by members of his army in Asia Minor in 223 BCE. Seleucus' second younger brother, Antiochus III, took the throne at the time at the age of 18 after his brother's death. And Antiochus III victoriously went through Judea and almost coming to the borders of Egypt. Verse number 11, the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hands of his enemy. Antiochus III met Ptolemy IV, Philopater, at the Battle of Raphia, also known as the Battle of Gaza, in 217 BCE. Now, Antiochus III was the king of the north. He had about 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 103 war elephants. But the forces of Ptolemy IV, the king of the south, were victorious in the battle, and Antiochus III was forced to withdraw back to Lebanon. Verse number 12. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. So here you got another battle between these kings going back and forth. I'm not going to get into all those details. I'll skip over this particular one here. And we'll go to verse number 13. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now, after the death of Ptolemy IV in 204 BC, Antiochus III rallied his forces once again to attack the king of the south. In the fifth Syrian war, which lasted between 202 and 195 BCE, Antiochus III swept down into Judea from Syria. He retook the territory that he had occupied some 18 years previously. When Antiochus III withdrew for the winter, the Egyptian commander Scopas reconquered the southern portions of the lost territory, including Judea and Jerusalem. And see, this is the reason why this prophecy is kind of important, because you had these kings of the north and the kings of the south, and every time that they fought each other, they had to go through Jerusalem. They had to go through Judea, which always affected the Jewish people that were living there. And that's why this was always something that was important. And a lot of these explanations I got here, I got some of this, I got a whole nother sheet here that's just from something that Tom Robinson put together, another explanation. I'm reading another one. It matches up pretty much with this one, but a little bit more detail. Verse 14, and now in those times shall many arise against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fail. What's being said here is in Antiochus III, he negotiated an alliance with King Philip V of Macedonia to divide up Egypt's Asian possessions. After some temporary setbacks at Gaza, Antiochus III's army inflicted a crushing defeat on the Ptolemaic forces about 199 BCE at Peneus, near the headwaters of the Jordan River. Now, regarding the prophecies of the actions of the Jews, because if you notice what it said there, that the Jews would be involved with this as well. Josephus writes that, yet the battle was long after when Antiochus overcame Scopas in the battle that was fought at the fountains of Jordan and destroyed a great part of his army. But afterward, when Antiochus subdued those cities which Scopas had gotten into his position, and Samaria with them, the Jews of their own accord went over to him and received him at the city of Jerusalem, and gave plenty of provisions to all of his armies and his elephants, and readily assisted him when he besieged the garrison that was at the citadel of Jerusalem. Unfortunately, the Jewish assistance was not going to be remembered when Antiochus the Fourth later came against Jerusalem. Forgot all about the Jews helping them. Verse number 15. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. The fulfillment of this was Antiochus came to the city of Sidon, which a fortified city, and besieged it. And Scopas actually surrendered finally for a safe passage out of the city to get back to Egypt. And his troops were allowed to leave the city naked after they gave up their weapons. Humiliating. I would hate to have, being an army soldier, I would have to hate to have to do that. Verse number 16. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. With this final victory over Scopas the Sidon, Antiochus the Great took the Holy Land away from the Egyptians for good. Judea and Jerusalem had passed from the king of the south to the king of the north now. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. Now this is an interesting turn of events right here. Pay attention to this one here. Young Ptolemy the Fifth had entered into a treaty with Antiochus III after his military defeat in the Fifth Syrian War. Through this treaty, Antiochus III tried to strengthen his position, expand his empire a little bit further. Ptolemy the Fifth surrendered his Asian holdings to the king of the north and accepted Antiochus III's daughter as his bride. Her name was Cleopatra the First. Cleopatra the First. They were married in 194 BCE. Through this marriage, Antiochus sought to gain a foothold in Egypt itself through his daughter. But his plan backfired. Cleopatra the First was a true wife to Ptolemy the Fifth, standing by him instead of seeking to benefit her father. Cleopatra I was beloved by the Egyptian people for her loyalty to her husband. And because of that, there were subsequent Cleopatras that were named after that, leading all the way up to the last reigning queen of Egypt, Cleopatra. Don't ask me what number that one was, but the last one. Verse number 18. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to the end, and the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. So in 192 BCE, the ambitious Antiochus III, he crossed into Greece to aid the Aetolians And he sent ambassadors to Rome, asking for friendship. However, the Roman Senate replied that they would be friends if Antiochus III left the Greeks in Asia free and independent if he swept away from Europe. So now the Roman Empire was already starting to rise up. They already had a Senate. They're starting to grow during this time frame here. Antiochus III refused, and he went to war against Rome. With 10,000 men, Antiochus III sailed across the Aegean Sea and took some strongholds in Asia Minor. But in doing so, he alienated his former ally, the Macedonian king Philip V. So the Roman army entered Asia Minor, defeated the larger forces of Antiochus III at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BCE. In the peace treaty that happened, Roman general Publius Scipio set a high cost on Antiochus III for peace. He demanded 20 hostages, including his son, Antiochus IV. Now, this is very interesting, Antiochus IV. A reduction of the naval ships to 12 and a payment to Rome for the cost of the war, which totaled 15,000 talents over the next 12 years. All the consuming ambition of Antiochus III had finally been brought to defeat in the kingdom of the north. Now, verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. As a consequence of this Roman victory over Antiochus III in the outlying provinces of the Seleucid Empire, again asserted their independence. With his kingdom now reduced to Syria, Mesopotamia, and western Iran, Antiochus III was in dire need of funds with which to pay Rome for the cost of the war. So in 187 BCE, while attempting to plunder a pagan temple in Babylon, near Susa, Antiochus III was murdered. Antiochus the Great was gone. Verse number 20. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Antiochus III's eldest son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, took over after his father's death. Due to a heavy debt burden opposed to Rome, he was forced to seek an ambitious taxation policy on his shrunken empire, bringing that taxation. This included heavy taxation on the people of Israel as well, so it affected them. In fact, Seleucus IV even sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to the temple of Jerusalem to extract money from the temple. Now, the Roman Senate decided to trade hostages. Therefore, they ordered Seleucus IV to send his son Demetrius, the heir to the throne, to Rome. In return, the Romans released Seleucus IV's younger brother, Antiochus IV. When released, Antiochus IV went to Athens. In 175 BCE, after Demetrius had been sent away to Rome, Seleucus IV was poisoned by his minister, Heliodorus. Some historians think that Heliodorus desired to throw him himself, while others believe that Antiochus IV was behind the murder. I'll go with the latter, knowing much about him. Seleucus' younger son, another Antiochus, was only age 5. He was put on the throne in his place. However, Heliodorus was the actual power behind the throne at the time. We're going to stop right here, and we will continue next Sabbath with Daniel's prophecies about Antiochus the Fourth, otherwise known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And also, we're going to go beyond that to the time of the return of Christ. That's a whole lot more detail that's involved with that. But Antiochus Epiphanes, he's the one that besieged Jerusalem, and he's the one that set up the abomination of desolation that is referred to. He was one bad dude. But we will continue next time talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and get a little bit more information about that. Today, my hope was that you were able to see that we can trust the Bible as authentic and accurate. This is God's inspired word. Daniel's prophecies are true. Think of all the prophecies of Daniel. If this was a book was a fraud, it throws out a whole lot. It would also discredit the prophecies that Jesus gave in Matthew 24, because they match with Daniel. It would also totally destroy the revelation of Jesus Christ that he gave to John, because they match up exactly the same. So I hope that you understand that this book of Daniel is inspired by God. It is proof that God is in control of everything. He knows everything. And he can tell the future. There are many other proofs that do show the Bible to be the written truth, but for lack of time, we cannot cover all of it. But there's just so much more. But I do encourage you to do your own research, and you will find many. The Word of God is truth.